from the Sky News Centre at 5. The Football Association has confirmed that John Terry has been dropped as England captain. Manager Fabio Capello has taken the decision after a week of allegations about the defender's private life. The Chelsea skipper says he'll still continue to give everything for his country. Rio Ferdinand replaces him as captain. Neil Ashton from the News of the World says Capello has proved he's got a ruthless streak.
It sends a message out to England's players and certainly England's captain that misbehave and you'll go back to the rank and file, and that's exactly what has happened here. John Terry just becomes another England player.
And the woman at the centre of the allegations involving John Terry has announced that she won't be talking publicly about them. In a statement issued through her publicist, Max Clifford, Vanessa Perrincell says she doesn't want to add more fuel to the fire.
In recent days, I have been the centre of a great deal of press speculation and comment. The details of my friendship with John and his family have been the subject of intense and wholly unfair and untrue media speculation.
Other news in brief now, and a wealthy Gloucestershire landowner has been found guilty of murdering his wife, who disappeared 2 years ago. Kate Prout went missing the day after she demanded an £800,000 divorce settlement from her estranged husband, Adrian. The Tory peer facing criminal charges over parliamentary expenses has resigned as a frontbench Tory business spokesman. Lord Hanningfield is also resigning as leader of Essex County Council. He and three Labour MPs, who are also accused, insist they've done nothing wrong. BAE Systems has agreed to pay fines totalling £286 million to settle corruption charges with the Serious Fraud Office and US Department of Justice. The move will see the defence giant plead guilty to two charges. Policing and justice powers in Northern Ireland will be devolved from April the 12th. The agreement follows 2 weeks of talks between the main political parties. And Harry Potter star Emma Watson's been named Hollywood's highest paid female star. The 19-year-old is said to have raked in £20 million last year. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Had a funny turn. Perhaps your speech was slurred or you couldn't pick up your cup of tea. You may well have had a mini stroke, also called a TIA. Mini strokes are an early warning sign. Spotting the signs of a mini stroke early and getting treatment can significantly reduce the risk of a full-blown stroke. Like a stroke, a mini stroke happens when the flow of blood to the brain is blocked by a small clot. But unlike a full stroke, with a mini stroke you'll often feel much better within a few hours. Don't ignore them. If you think you may have had a mini stroke in the past, talk to your GP. Strokes happen to people we care about. Act fast. Brought to you by NHS Bristol. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guest this week to discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world is karate expert as well as Freemason victim and campaigner Jerry Coulter. Our regular Oxford economist and old Labour pundit Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news this week, Billy Quain will be along with his credit crunch beating good value What's on Guide. Also after six, we hear Jerry's story of how he was a victim of Dorset Freemasons, took them on and won. And in an exclusive interview, we hear from an ex-Special Forces soldier who lives in Bristol. He unburdens himself tonight at 6:45. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-week Bristol weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, averaging 3 degrees Celsius and a cloudy but dry weekend. Next week, a little cooler, down to 2, a fairly dry week with some sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of February, averaging 2 degrees in the daytime, dry with plenty of sun. That was a long-range weather forecast for the next 2 weeks from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and joining us this evening is a karate expert and campaigning Freemason victim, Jerry Coulter. Jerry, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for bringing me on the show.
Now, tell me, how did the Freemasons come to your attention?
Well, all started a long time ago, in 1995. Really, I always knew about Freemasonry, but I just thought that these were people who, worked for charity and wore aprons and rolled up their trouser legs and did all sorts of weird rituals, but I didn't really pay any attention to the fact that they could be so detrimental towards a person. If they felt like it.
So how did you actually come across them? Or how did they come to your attention?
Oh. Basically, it all started, I live in Hertfordshire. I had a vehicle stolen in Dorset. And normally, in the case of a stolen vehicle, especially when the thief pleads guilty to the car theft and it's been dealt with by the courts, you would expect the police to impound the vehicle so that you could get your vehicle back. Unfortunately, in my case, my car had been sold to a Bournemouth car dealer who was the brother of a serving police sergeant at the time who was a member of Branksome Lodge. And all sorts of strange things were going on. I was being threatened by the police, bearing in mind I was a victim of a car theft. When I was trying to speak to them and make complaints to the complaints department in Wynthrath as to why I wasn't getting any assistance or why my car's not being impounded so that I could then get a civil court order for delivery up of my vehicle, that I'm getting sort of hostile reactions from police officers and everything. And then I'm getting subliminal threats from the complaints department. So I followed the normal procedures that you do in a situation like this, which is to lobby the councillors that are on the police authority, who are the checks and balances in our society. And I start getting whisperings that, oh, this is all to do with Freemasonry. I'll come on to a bit more of that a bit later on.
Okay, and what about karate? What's your sort of interest in karate and what have you done?
Well, basically, I'm a senior grade in Wadaroo karate. Many people in Bristol here train in Wadaroo karate. It's one of the major Japanese styles of karate. Back in the early 80s, I was married into a Japanese family and an old honourable samurai family. And I actually did a lot of extensive training in Japan and in this country with Japanese instructors here. Many people in Bristol would have trained with the same instructors that I train with. Shimizu Sensei is one of them who's resident over here. I also trained with the Wadaroo Grandmaster and Nichi Dai in Japan, which is the Wadaroo testing ground.
And finally, you're also an engineer. What do you do as an engineer?
I'm a self-employed engineer. I overhaul parts and components for jet aircraft engines and jet engines used in industrial applications, and also I make parts for classic cars, old Rolls Royces and old vehicles, old Jensens and things that are no longer made.
Martin Summers is here too. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, by way of introduction this week, why is the special company UK Financial Services Limited, which was set up by the government to administer the taxpayers' interests in the banks, why is it not actually using its power as a shareholder to tell the banks to loan to industry?
Well, there's a fundamental contradiction in the situation. Let's remember, no sensible bank is going to lend in a situation where there's no demand in the economy. So the government are asking contradictory things of the banks. They're asking them to make themselves solvent and at the same time to lend money out. Now, these are two contradictory things, and I don't think the government, or any government really, has faced up to the reality that no private sector bank, which is basically profit-oriented, is going to lend to people if they don't think they can get the money back. And that is the situation as long as the demand equation in the economy is so weak. And so the fundamental problem is to get demand into the economy, and we need to reform the banking system completely, and we're probably never going to go back to a completely private banking system, and I think that's something that they still haven't got their heads around.
So why have the government set up this UK Financial Services Limited?
Because of the sort of free market ideology that's been running around for the last 20 or 30 years, the idea that the government could control the banks and direct them to do things is anathema. So the idea is that you set up this arm's length organisation like a quango to manage the banks, but it's not the government directly. Now, of course, you don't want a situation where MPs or ministers can fund their pet projects through the banking system. So you'd have to have some kind of mechanism for doing this, whatever you were going to do. But you know, they're still not facing the fundamental contradiction that the private banking system is not just in illiquid, it's insolvent, and they need to actually, in an orderly way, actually wind up most of the existing banking system and start again from the beginning and cancel a lot of the debt, which means a lot of wealthy people will have to lose money. But I'm afraid that's the bet you take when you bet on a capitalist market casino. If you lose your money, you lose your money, and somebody's going to have to pay, and it's definitely going to have to be those with the money, because nobody else has got any.
Thanks, Martin. Right, well, let's have a look at some of this week's stories. First of all, the big story today is to do with the expenses scandal. We have 392 of our MPs are being ordered to pay back expenses, as well as three facing criminal charges. Jerry, what are your thoughts, first of all, about this? Is this justice, finally, in the expenses scandal?
Well, if these people that are actually going to be facing charges actually end up not only being indicted but convicted, and the media actually say what happened to these people as a deterrent against others. Unfortunately, in a lot of these cases, the CPS, for whatever reason, don't continue prosecutions against people. People will just end up getting a rap over the knuckles. But what really annoys me is that you've got over 600 of these people up there in the House. They're passing law. They're the legislators that are there trying to keep you and I in line and all the rest of the taxpayers in this country in line and telling us what we can do. And they've got a racket like that going on. And even those that are not facing criminal charges are going to have to pay money back or have abused the system, albeit possibly in good faith, but they've been given a long, long leash to carry on with, haven't they, over a long period of time?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with any of that. Clearly, we've got a mess of a system. I mean, as we know, the MPs were encouraged to claim the expenses because the whole thing of giving them a pay rise was too controversial, and the whole idea of them paying for voting on their own pay rise seemed to, so that they were told, claim the expenses and that's the way we'll reimburse you. And you've got to remember that many MPs have got other outside interests besides being MPs. That's another thing that we've lost sight of here. If I'm employed as a job to be an MP or whatever, or if I was employed to work for Bristol City Council, as I once was, you can't do a moonlighting job on the side as well, although in fact you can if you're an MP. Now, in the past, of course, MPs actually, their MP activities were often kind of a sideline. They were lawyers or they were doing something else in the daytime, which is why Parliament used to meet in the afternoons, so that they had plenty of time to do all their other work in the mornings. I think we need to have a good, hard look at the whole way in which we manage all of this, because it's become a sewer, and we need to clean it out. But I'd also say this: it's been jolly convenient for the bankers, for the MPs to be in the firing line, and the timing of all of this I'm very suspicious of, because it's the MPs ought to have been disciplining the bankers. Oh, but they can't do that because they've got their own dirty linen to wash.
Well, you have the conflict of interest there, don't you? As soon as an MP becomes an MP, they're offered directorships. You've only got to go to the House of Commons website and then go on to the Declaration of Interest, and you find people like Oliver Letwin MP, an MP in Dorset, for example, who is also a director of the Rothschilds Group. I mean, if that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what is, especially at one point he had a shadow position in as a Treasury, shadow Treasury spokesman.
Would you agree, Martin? Do you think that that's, I mean, surely what he's able to do as a director of NM Rothschild & Sons, as well as his role as a politician, is to share the skills. I mean, surely we want people who are at the heart of the City of London also in government. We don't want these two organisations fighting each other.
I understand the argument in favour of that. You don't just want professional politicians, that's all they've done all their lives is be professional politicians. But on the other hand, you've also got this conflict of interest question really does have to be addressed. It reminds me of what John Smith, when he was a leader of the Labour Party, he was a top barrister, and he was approached by Conservative friends who said, well, what are you doing being leader of the Labour Party? You're going to earn 30 grand doing that. You're a top barrister. You could earn that in a month. And John Smith just said, they just don't get it, do they? It's actually an honour. And that's why I want to be leader of the Labour Party, and that's why I'd like to be Prime Minister. And it's not the money that's motivating me here.
But it's not quite so much of an honour to be a politician nowadays, is it? It seems that politicians haven't got quite such a good name.
Well, they don't deserve one, do they?
Well, how can you ask politicians like Oliver Letwin and other politicians who have been up to their necks in abusing their expenses, like anyone for tennis, Mr. Letwin, that had a pipe under his tennis court at his home in Chard in Somerset, repaired and put it on his MP's expenses. How can you expect him to bring bankers like Fred Goodwin into line for having obscene bonuses and running RSB Group into the ground when they've got a racket like that going on in the house?
So do you think now we've had this announcement of the potentially three lawmakers being charged and many more, 300, nearly 400 actually, having to pay back expenses, do you think that's going to draw a line under it and restore voter confidence?
Clearly not. We need changes in the voting system. We need changes in the rules have got to be absolutely clear and transparent. We've got into this mess because the rules are a mess themselves, and that's how we've got into it. And it's just got to be cleaned up, and hopefully after the next election we'll be in a position to put some new rules and regs in place which we can all adhere to, and everybody can see what we're supposed to be doing.
Okay, next story today, we have some very good news from Northern Ireland, and let's just go over to IRM for a quick report.
After 10 days and nights of talks, the DUP came to an agreement with Sinn Féin at midnight. The last piece of the political jigsaw brought to an end the longest set of continuous negotiations held in the near 20-year peace process. Gordon Brown and his Irish counterpart Brian Cohen finalised the deal at Hillsborough Castle this morning. The PM says today secured the future for Northern Ireland.
Power being where it should be, in the hands of the people of Northern Ireland, the strongest answer to those who would bring violence back to our streets. And today's agreement is the opportunity for a fresh start.
The settlement will see the devolution of policing and justice powers from Westminster to the Stormont Assembly.
OK, well, that was a slightly curtailed report from IRN then on the eventual power-sharing agreement deal, which was made late last night, early this morning. Martin, do you think this is as historic as some people are saying, or is it just another little blip on the way to peace in Ireland?
Well, it's more than a blip, and I'm actually quite surprised that they managed to get a deal, because so close to the general election, both the Republican and the DUP people were probably hoping that they might be able to grandstand their way through the election and then try and do a deal after the election.
Well, some of the smaller parties are complaining, aren't they, saying that we haven't actually been involved in this process. You know, you can't have peace without involving everybody.
Yeah, that's right. But, of course, don't forget the DUP and Sinn Féin represent a certain strand of hardline opinions on both sides of the divide, and getting their agreement is essential if everybody else is going to be happy with it in the end, although there is in fact problems to the DUP's right with the I can't remember what they're called now, the True Ulster Party or something, and there is a danger here that this agreement will go the same way as other agreements, as people split off both ends of the spectrum. But to be honest with you, who would have said 10 years ago even that we would be able to have this kind of news where policing is going to be shared and the responsibility is going to be shared, both sides of the community, Mr. Ian Paisley's party and the party of the IRA are going to cooperate together to bring peace to the country. Well, it is pretty amazing.
Well, why has policing been such a thorny issue over the years?
Well, because obviously policing's the heart of the problem, isn't it? I mean, trusting the state to do its business and do it properly has always been at the heart of the issue.
Well, that all depends whether you trust the police and the man on the ground and whether you trust the police authority that's controlling these people. It's my belief that most councils, most police authorities, most police forces, most local authorities, I mean, we've just been discussing what's happening at central government. All this percolates down. You have the same thing with councillors and police authority members gathering expenses for attending these arms-length organisations and quangos. You try lobbying any of them and see what response you get. I mean, basically, they've all got their snouts in the ratepayers' pot and they don't really care, apart from their own ends.
Do you think that then that there are all of the MPs, all of the councillors are on the take?
Well, I don't say they all are, but let's put it this way. My experience and the experience of a lot of people that have had come out of the school of hard knocks, that have reached the conclusions that I've reached by looking at facts, right? Facts rather than conspiracy theories. It gives a picture that most public institutions in this country are either corrupt, dishonest, corrupt at the maximum, dishonest at the minimum, and controlled by Freemasonry to a degree.
Okay, Martin.
Can I just comment on that? I mean, I think it's quite important that there's been several assassination attempts, some successful assassination attempts on police service of Northern Ireland police officers in recent weeks, and the real IRA in particular are targeting Catholic police officers. And I don't think anybody from the IRA or from the Republican side would accuse the RUC of being, personally corrupt. They've never seen eye to eye. In fact, the IRA have killed many police officers in their time, but they didn't kill them for having their fingers in the till. And I think that the motivations of everybody concerned in Northern Ireland have been not entirely driven by pecuniary motives, although, of course, that has come into it. Of course, racketeering has been a feature of what's been going on in that society. But I think the attempt to try and build a consensus around a police force that serves the whole community is at the root of this agreement last night. And I agree that there's always got to be checks and balances. We've always got to be corrupt police officers are always going to be there. When Condon took over as the head of the Met years ago, he gave a press conference and he said, "I've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is 120 of my officers are corrupt and are working with the criminals. The good news is we know who they are and we're keeping an eye on them. That is all." And that's always been the way, and it's a continuous struggle to keep the police on the straight and narrow. Police officers are always tempted, especially if they're not very well paid, to take backhanders from the criminals they're supposed to be policing.
But keeping an eye on them, Martin, that's not really good enough, is it? I mean, surely if they have evidence
most of these people were forced out in the end. The point is that they were trained police officers, and they never go to speak to anybody without their brief and all the rest of it. So it's very difficult to get rid of them, and things have to be done by the book. Getting rid of people has to be done by the book as well, and that's what's tricky. Of course, in Northern Ireland, people cut to the chase, and they didn't bother with the book. They just went round and shot them in the head because they didn't like them. Now, that's not a very suitable way to proceed either, I don't think. I mean, the book is the book, and that's what that book. We've got to make the book stick.
Unfortunately, Ireland has a 300-year history of people feeling that they've been oppressed on the Republican side, and people on the other side feeling that they have to defend and protect what they have and their links to the UK. Mm. And it is a very, very difficult situation. Yes, there's theories that the loyalist paramilitaries didn't ever decommission their arms, and they stopped fighting a cause and ended up as gangsters. There's also conspiracy theories that they were involved in the big bank job that was in Ireland.
That's a big mystery who did that.
Yeah.
Nobody knows who did that.
But it was done with military precision.
Oh, yes.
I mean, only a paramilitary organisation would have had the infrastructure to carry out something like that in a province like Ireland, as opposed to a gang of thugs coming over from London criminals.
Oh, it was an interesting operation. But of course, they stole Northern Irish banknotes as well, and so the only place you can spend them is inside Northern Ireland. So then whoever stole them has got loads and loads.
Well, I'm of Irish origin, so I can be a bit un-PC here and say, well, they are Irish.
Yes.
Okay, so do you think ultimately this is going to be a really good move, Gerry? Now we've got some, apparently, at least to begin with, a power-sharing deal, particularly a deal on policing.
Well, I hope that you will have people on that police authority, moderates, not the extremes. I mean, I believe this deal was thrashed out with the most extreme factions, with people like Martin McGuinness and the head of the Loyalist Party, people like the more moderate Republican factions, the SDLP, to a degree were left out of all of this. And I hope that when the police authority is put together, you'll have more moderate people from both sides.
OK, I'll give you the final word, Martin.
Well, I'm sure they will have people from both sides. We're still not out of the woods yet. People will carry on rowing and arguing in Ireland into the next generation, but at least they won't be doing it with bombs and bullets, hopefully.
OK, our next story. Passengers urged to take part in review of bus services. This is from Bristol247.com. This is to do with Bristol's buses, and a review into bus services in Bristol has been ordered by the City Council in an attempt to better link 1930s bus routes within a 21st century city. The cost of bus travel is certain to be a major issue for passengers who are being invited to put forward their views. Now, Gerry, I mean, I know you're not a Bristol resident, but what's your experience of bus privatisation?
Well, generally, I think if it improves the service, then there's nothing wrong with having a private company taking over a route. But quite honestly, the old system is all but gone now, where there used to be local authority maintained public transport infrastructures and everything. All that seems to have gone. I really don't know.
Well, I mean, as Jerry says, it's largely the infrastructure has largely been the previous infrastructure of local authority control has been eroded away. But as we've said on this programme for many weeks, when we come to back to the bus issue, which is a major issue in Bristol, as we know, that people get upset about, is that there's a natural monopoly in local transport. I mean, it's unlikely. Most major cities in Britain have got one major supplier, and that's the reason why these things were put in the hands of the local authorities in the first place. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. Many of the routes that they run are subsidised routes, particularly the ones that run into the sticks, where there's not a great deal of passengers. And if you're going to subsidise somebody, well, why let them make a profit as well? I mean, if you're going to subsidise something, you might as well just subsidise it and have done. But of course, things that were common sense in 1962 have now become unthinkable. And that's one of the reasons why we've got ourselves into a big economic mess, because lots of the things that we thought we knew how to do, we decided we didn't know how to do them and threw the textbook away.
One of the other little points being made in this article on Bristol247.com, it says, and a transport debate hosted by the Institute of Directors in September last year, someone called Justin Davis said the only real way to produce a big uptake of public transport in Bristol was to force cars off the road. So is that something you agree with? Or?
Can I just say, you shouldn't force cars. What you could do is make buses free, which they do in some European cities. And then you can get in your car and pay to drive into town, or you can go into town
free
on the bus.
Well, I think the chief executive of First Bus might not agree with you on that one, Martin. Jerry?
Well, yeah, as you say, in some countries they do this, and or it's heavily subsidised by the municipal council. You know, this is particular in places like Eastern European countries and things like that.
Japan, I would have thought, there's quite a lot of subsidy for their public transport there, haven't
there? There is a lot of subsidy for public transport, because they found out that when they privatised JNR and everything, it still couldn't cope without government and local help.
Okay, then next story, we've got Marina Morris has come in, and she's got, we've got the up-and-coming Ukrainian elections, which we've been covering for several weeks here on Friday Drive Time. The final part of the election is on this coming Sunday, and the reason that we're really following the Ukrainian elections closely is because it will be a very interesting indicator, apart from being the largest country in Europe, as to which way some of these former Soviet states are going. Now, Marina, we've got a report for us on the Ukrainian election.
Oh, yes. Hello. On Sunday, Ukrainians will vote in election to choose a successor to outgoing President Viktor Yushchenko from two candidates, Viktor Yanukovych and Yulia Tymoshenko. Yulia Tymoshenko, Ukraine's prime minister, appears to be doing unexpectedly well by winning support from the eliminated candidates and may well defeat the former front-runner, opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych. Mrs. Tymoshenko has pressed repeatedly for this candidates to spy TV debates, but Mr. Yanukovych has refused, saying he would not enter a competition in dirt and lies, and adding, if she is to be treated as a woman, let her demonstrate her whims in the kitchen. Equal opportunities to Ukraine style. Critics of Yanukovych have said that the real reason that he did not partake is not to hide lies his lack of orative skills. This week, after Mr. Yanukovych rejected yet another invitation to a TV debate, Mrs. Tymoshenko appears alone and berated her revile for 100 minutes, repeatedly pointed out his empty lecterns. She said, although he is absent from here, I can feel his smell. This is the smell of fear. I do not want a common coward to become the next leader of our nation. And also, she said, the majority of Ukrainians' voters showed they are ready to vote for democracy against criminal gangs and oligarchy. What personality traits are the Ukrainian and world press using to present both candidates? Mrs. Tymoshenko, the glamorous prime minister, a charismatic performer and orator, Ukraine's fiery prime minister who has failed to deliver much that was promised by the Orange Revolution. Her candidacy was endorsed by Europe's largest political grouping, the European People's Party, while Mr. Yanukovych, region's party, has forged a partnership with United Russia, the party of Vladimir Putin, Russia's prime minister. By contrast, Mr. Yanukovych, the square-jawed opposition leader, is a poor speaker, a post-Soviet, very bureaucratic, nomenclature-type politician, but who could benefit from general disillusionment. Tymoshenko and Yanukovych are quite different political personalities and would take a different approach on a number of fundamental issues, particular foreign policy. Yanukovych says Mrs. Tymoshenko is a fast talker who failed to deliver, but Mrs. Tymoshenko, Deputy Prime Minister, dismissed this, seeing her as a European pro-democratic leader. Russia has kept its distance, but to Moscow's satisfaction, both leading candidates have stressed their desire to improve relations with Russia. As one pro-Kremlin Russian MP says, we have bet on both of them. Recently, Ukraine and Russia have publicly accused each other of spying. Ukraine claims to have caught five Russian spies. The head of Ukraine Security Service said they were trying to obtain military secrets. Four of them have been expelled, while the fifth have been detained. The Russia FSB said its actions were a response to the recruitment of Russians by the Ukrainian Security Service. Just 2 weeks ago, Russia sent an ambassador to Ukraine after a 5-month absence. If and how this incident will affect future relation is unclear. The outgoing president Viktor Yushchenko's time in office has been marked by strained relations with Moscow, and his departure is being seen an opportunity for an improvement in ties between the two countries. Whichever candidates win, the president will face an European Union skeptical about Ukraine's capacity for integration and U.S. preoccupied with non-European issues. While sticking to European membership's plan, the new president's priority will be restoring political stability and confidence in the recession-hit economy and resuming cooperation with the International Monetary Fund, which has suspended a $16.4 billion package. From a European Union point of view, it is important that the election's second round proceeds calmly and that the winner is able to arrange a smooth transfer of power with Yushchenko. This will ease the European Union's worry about political instability or deadlock in Ukraine, and one hopes will speed up the negotiation on European Union-Ukrainian Association Agreement.
So, Marina, I have to ask you, which way is your money on? Do you think the Ukrainian election is going to be a swing to the west or a swing to the east?
My hope and my vote for Ukraine's integration to the European Union and freedom.
Okay, lovely. Thanks very much. Now, Jerry, I don't know how much you know about European affairs, but what's your thoughts on the outcome potentially on Sunday of this very important election in Europe?
Well, as a matter of fact, as a self-employed engineer, I was one of the first engineers that went out to Eastern Europe just after the Berlin Wall was kicked down, trying to take engineering work to former MiG factories that, bear in mind, these were Warsaw Pact arms companies that were going through the transition of being privatised. They couldn't do any CIA or FAA work at that time because they didn't meet our audit. They were working to Warsaw Pact audit, which was pretty stringent, I must say, and they were only just getting ISO 9000 in. And I think it's very important to support these fragile democracies and economies where they've gone from a communist state system into the capitalist free market with, how can I put it, very little idea of the cut and thrust and the corruption that you have out here, despite they had their own in their own countries. While I'm on that point, in Romania in particular, which I knew quite a lot about, as I say, I was out there taking engineering work there, they swept away the corruption beautifully. They gave it a Latin name, like they do in law. Instead of a bribe, if you declared it and put it across the table, if I was to give you an ex gratia payment with its Latin name, that's legal. And you declare it for tax and the government get their bit, right? This is how they got rid of the man with the black leather jacket who would come and smash up the lorry were going outside the factory gate if they didn't get their bribe. They actually did away with the Russian mafia overnight by putting all the bribes out in the open, legalising them and bringing them within the system.
Well, what are you asking me about the Ukrainian election? I mean, obviously, I had something to do with this. I was working in Eastern Europe at the same sort of time as Jerry. I was an aid worker and I was also an economic advisor for the New Economics Foundation. I mean, on the Ukrainian election, I think what's really, really good is that the first round was very clean. There's a nice, clear choice for the electorate now in the second round. And also that the Russians seem to be happy about Tymoshenko, even if she wins. Whether the West will be happy if she doesn't win is another matter. But I think it's important for Ukraine to be on good terms with the West and to be on good terms with the Russians. They're in the middle there. There was a potential danger that some kind of internal conflict could blow up in the Ukraine, because you've got Russian speakers in the East and Ukrainian speakers in the West, and there's a potential for fracture there in the same kind of way as we saw in former Yugoslavia. The Crimea, for example, is a potential flashpoint because it's got a Russian-speaking majority, it's got a Russian naval base there, but it's actually in Ukrainian territory. This is a result of Khrushchev deciding that it was part of Ukraine in the 50s. And of course, the danger of conflict over borders, we've seen what the danger of that in the Balkans. I was an aid worker in former Yugoslavia, and of course, once people start fighting over what state they belong to, then all kinds of arguments about what to do with the economy and so on go by the board.
You're talking about the Georgia conflict 18
months ago.
Well, no,
I was talking about the Yugoslavian conflict, but the Georgia conflict will be another example of that. I mean, we don't want to see that in Ukraine, do we? I mean, Ukraine's a big country, a lot of people, and a very important country, and we don't want to see them going down that road. But I think the way the election has been conducted, because there's been a lot of mudslinging going on, but I think that all the observers have said that the first round was clean and fair, and that I'm sure that the next round will be clean and fair, whoever wins. And of course, that's the way you do it. You play a clean game, and then whoever wins is entitled to rule the country for the subsequent period.
Okay. Well, we'll find out what happens this weekend. Now, Claire Short has claimed this week that the cabinet was misled on the legality of the war, the Iraq war, at the Chilcot inquiry. Tony Blair's cabinet was misled, apparently, into thinking the Iraq war was legal. So let's have a listen now to Claire Short giving her evidence at the Chilcot inquiry on Tuesday this week.
The cabinet doesn't work in the way, and didn't under the whole of the time I was in government, in the way that, according to our constitutional theory, it's supposed to work. If ever you raised an issue that you wanted to bring to the cabinet, Tony Blair would see you beforehand and cut it off.
Who misled the cabinet?
The Attorney General. I think now we know everything that we know about his doubts and his changes of opinion and what the Foreign Office legal advisers were saying, and that he'd got this private side deal that Tony Blair said there was a material breach when Blix was saying he needed more time. I think for the Attorney General to come and say there's an unequivocal legal authority to go to war was misleading. I see that both Tony Blair and he said the cabinet were given the chance to ask questions. That is untrue. I mean, everything was very fraught by then, and they didn't want me arguing, and I was kind of geared at to be quiet, and that's what happened.
Went quiet?
Well, I mean, if he won't answer, and the Prime Minister's saying, be quiet and that's it, no discussion, there's only so much you can do. When you add secrecy and deceit, the system becomes positively dangerous, and I'm still shocked that Britain could do what happened in Iraq, and it makes me fear for our government system, and we need to learn the lessons so that it can never malfunction so dreadfully again.
Do you think, Martin, that maybe Claire Short's over-egging the pudding a little bit here? Because, I mean, surely she should have spoken out more at the time. And also, many people are raising questions about whether it was right for her to stay in the cabinet. Surely, if she was a person of principle, she would have resigned.
Well, as they used to say in Sunday school, hell hath more heaven is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner that repenteth than on all of those that were good all the time. I mean, she should have resigned, of course. But now she's saying, she herself would say, I should have resigned, I was wrong about that, I should have resigned. And how often do you get that in politics, where people actually say, no, I was wrong there, I should have taken a tougher line? If she had resigned or voted against the government, Blair had basically bullied the Parliamentary Labour Party, said, if I don't get a majority of the Parliamentary Labour Party supporting the war, I will resign. and he only got a majority of two or three, I think. So if Claire Short had voted against and a couple of people had gone with her, Blair would not have had the support of the Parliamentary Labour Party and his bluff would have been called. I don't think he would have resigned because he's not that kind of chap, but it would have made it a lot more difficult for him if they had spoken out when they could have spoken out.
Well, also, I'm not sure if I'm wrong here, but I thought that he couldn't rely on the majority of support from his own backbenchers, and that's why the actual decision to go to war, he made an open vote in the House. He threw himself on the mercy of the Tories and the Liberals. It was a complete open vote, and he convinced everyone that Saddam Hussein could unleash weapons of mass destruction within a very short deployment time. Well, of course, handsplits were telling them for a long time that this was not the case, and when they finally invaded the place and didn't get any chemical weapons or nuclear devices thrown at them, they found out it was true. And the other question is, what are they still doing out there?
Well, I mean, what people say is they're still out there. I mean, there are British forces. People say that Britain's withdrawn and Britain's major forces have withdrawn, but we've still got lots of mercenaries out there. There are probably more, mercenary soldiers out there now than actual proper soldiers. And, of course, they say that we're staying because of these internal fights and so on, and the Iraqi government wants us to stay, although all the opinion polls in Iraq show that they want the Americans and the British out. They're staying because the oil's still there. That hasn't gone away, and they intend to get their piece of it.
Well, that's what it was all about in the first place. I mean, we live in quite a heavily censored country. A lot of the press that you get here doesn't home in on a lot of issues. I get the Japanese Asahi Shimbun at the time when all this was going on. As I say, you can pick up a newspaper in Singapore and you can read things that don't get denoticed here or pressure put on editors. And one of those things that it was imperative for regime change from a Japanese point of view was the fact that Saddam Hussein was about to sell oil, unlike the rest of the world where oil, a barrel of oil, is priced in US dollar. He was going to float their oil and sell it in euro.
I mean, is it, Martin, do you agree, is this a credible
Yes, it is. Of course,
motive
for war? The petrodollar regime we live under is a very important one. The Saudis have done a deal with the Americans that anybody who buys oil has to buy it in dollars, and it's very important for the US that people carry on having to buy oil in dollars. If people can access oil without using dollars, then they don't have to go through the US financial system to get what they want, and this allows the US to cream off essentially an economic rent from the fact that everybody has to have dollars to buy oil.
Well, as I read the article and as I understood it from the Japanese Asahi Shimbun, Japan has always had to import large amounts of oil. It's got no resources of its own. It's an island. They have to buy US dollars on the US on the currency markets in order to pay for that oil, which is sold, as I say, the oil is priced in dollar per barrel. And therefore, if a lot of countries like Japan that have to buy dollars, which keeps the American economy buoyant because of the currency markets, suddenly can pay in euro, that's going to damage the American economy overnight. That is why Saddam Hussein was such a threat, especially the people like Bush Senior and Dick Cheney, with companies like Halliburton and all the big oil companies and everything else. And there's all that Iraqi oil sitting out there about to be sold in euro. It was a catastrophe for them.
Well, it would have been.
Okay, and also, let's just get back to what Claire Short was saying for a minute. I mean, she did say there that there was no discussion in Cabinet about the rights and wrongs of the war and the decision to go to war. Doesn't that sound quite incredible?
It sounds extremely incredible, especially since they'd already had one opinion from a top civil servant, I believe, that it was illegal, unless it had a full United Nations mandate.
That's right, these were the lawyers at the Foreign Office.
And they were ignored. And, I mean, my question now is, if it is, or if on the balance of probability, it is proved that Blair lied, and that he and Bush took us into that war and carried out a regime change illegally to remove a supposed dictator and caused absolute chaos. There's been more killing than Saddam Hussein's regime ever did. And if all of this was just to capture Iraqi oil, then I think he should be standing trial alongside Milosevic in The Hague.
Well, many, many British people agree with you, Gerry. There was an opinion poll, was it, we were reading last night, Tony, was something like 28% think he should stand trial in The Hague. And somebody else quoted at 30. I think we are going to have to beef up the international system. I mean, isn't it extraordinary that the United States, the most powerful state on the planet, isn't signed up to the International Criminal Court? And why not? Well, because, of course, their torturers and murderers would have to stand trial there. And you can opt out of the legal system of the world if you want, but then we're entitled not to believe a word you say, because you're saying that you're above the law, you don't play by the same rules as everybody else, therefore we just presume that you're lying.
Well, I was always hoping that now the most powerful man in the world is not a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, I thought things would change, but I haven't seen it as yet.
Okay, thanks very much for those two. We've got Marina Morris back now, and Marina has a little report for us to discuss about the ageing population, and in particular, can we cheat dementia?
Negative. We can't cheat dementia. Europe's population is aging. Dementia, depression and other mental problems are now seen as a health and social care challenge for the 21st century. The UK's number of dementia sufferers is 15% higher than had been estimated, according to the Dementia 2010 report. Figures suggest that more than 1 million people will have developed the disease before 2025. The annual burden on the economy, meanwhile, is 35% higher than the previous calculation of £23 billion. Researchers from the Alzheimer's Research Trust say that our perception of this disease is one which primarily strikes in old age. This may influence what we are prepared to donate and result in much less research than cancer, heart disease, and many other causes. Campaigners say there needs to be greater commitment to tackling a condition for this. There is no effective treatment and no cure. In contrast, scientists from Stanford University found that older people in general were far less likely than the young to experience persistent negative moods and feel happy. They are also much better at controlling and balancing their emotions, a skill that appears to improve the older they become. Despite worries about ill health, income, change in social status and bereavements, later life tends to be a golden age, according to the psychologist. They found older adults generally make the best of the time they have left and have learned to avoid situations that make them feel sad or stressed. Can you cheat dementia? No, but you can improve your odds. Let's get back to our nature. Let's go to our roots. Ask yourself a very simple question. Who are you? Your physical body is an important part of your personality, but you experience everything throughout the mind. How about your huge emotional space, your dimension of feelings, your mental world, your inner kingdom? This hidden world is also an important part of your unique kingdom, whether this is a big or small territory. It contains another currency, your personal values, your potential of success, your time, energy, love, happiness and quality of life come from this world. To be a good citizen, you have to know the constitution and laws of your self-unity. Scientists from the Alzheimer Research Trust recommend exercise can have a beneficial effect at any age to help protect against dementia. Being seriously overweight or excess alcohol consumption are deemed risk factor for developing dementia. You need to have a balanced diet which reduces fat. Mental exercise helps keep the brain fit. A healthy body can help protect your brain, but exercise and diet, are they enough to reduce the risk of dementia or depression? A positive mental attitude and positive emotions are very fundamental to maintain a healthy lifestyle. It is a real weapon against disease. Our thoughts are the strongest and the fastest thing in the world. They create our reality. Stay positive, think big, think global. A new age needs a perception of who are you, a clear understanding of the self-concept and identity. This attitude can help protect you from future mental problems and feel happy every day. The Office for National Statistics forecast of the percentage of Bristol's population above the stage pension age and above the age of 84 shows interesting results. It forecast a decline in the percentages of pensioners and a stable percentage of those older than 84. This compares to a national trend of increase in the UK's average of both groups. It appears as if official forecasts are assuming that significant numbers of older citizens will move elsewhere. Whether this will be reflected in the provision of services for this group remains to be seen. We have seen how unreliable government forecast can be.
Okay, well, it's not a lot of pats on the back for the statisticians there. If we're hearing that in the future Bristol's pensioners are going to be moving out of the city, anyway, well, I suppose only time will tell if that ends up to be true or not. But anyway, thanks very much for that report, Marina. Jerry, can I just ask you to comment then quite quickly on what you think of this idea of the ageing population generally? We're not talking about the pensioners in Bristol who are apparently going to be reducing in numbers, but just generally the fact that people are living longer.
Well, people are living longer because you've got better food technologies, you've got better medical care, people are more conscious about their health, their diet. People generally are living longer physically, but when you're talking about things like Alzheimer's and people going senile, I mean, whether the brain will stay active as long, as you say, it's up to the individual person's constitution. But certainly, I mean, there are a lot of people that are quite elderly, quite active, both quite mentally sharp.
But this is, I mean, something that we're, I mean, do you think it's exaggerating, Martin, to call it the demographic time bomb?
Well, no, it's not exaggerating. There are some problems with an ageing population, and that's one of the reasons, for example, why most European countries have got young people coming in from outside to do a lot of the work and pay the taxes to keep the older generation. Dementia is going to be a more and more serious problem, as Jerry's indicated, because people are living physically longer, but they're not necessarily enjoying the what's left of their lives. My grandmother had dementia, and she lived for 20 years, but she didn't know what day of the week it was, and she didn't know who she was, and she didn't know who anybody else was. In some ways, she was okay, because she was so childlike that she didn't know what was happening, and she wasn't upset, she didn't worry, she didn't stress. But other kinds of dementia in my family, people, when they get old and they get senile, they get crotchety, they get aggressive, they get difficult. And that's much more difficult to live with, because these are people that you used to know and you used to be used to love, but they've become intolerable in their behaviour, and they can't help their behaviour. And I think that's very, very sad and very, very challenging.
Well, I'm 55 years old, and as you introduced me earlier, I mean, I still run a karate school, and I'm still a full-contact karate fighter. Only last year, I was fighting at the Okinawan Karate Festival, as well as refereeing there, fighting their veterans. And I don't know what's more frightening to a person like me that's 55 years old, but pretty much got a tuned-up body. I mean, you can see me. There's not a bit of fat on me. My hair's a bit grey, but but physically, I'm fitter than a lot of guys in their 20s and 30s, you know. And I mean, I don't know which is more frightening, for me to have a decent physical body when I'm moving into old age and my mind is shot and I don't know what's going on around me, or whether I'm going to be stuck in a wheelchair being spoon-fed with an active brain stuck in a body that's wrecked. I mean, either of those possibilities is not a particularly nice one.
Well, what are your thoughts, though, Jerry, about health and generally and diet and that kind of thing? So obviously, your fitness is very important to you. Do you have a particular? Do you have particularly sort of diet rules and things to do with fitness to keep you going?
This is just my own Jerry Coulter rule. I believe that, you see, I don't believe in this thing about you shouldn't eat high cholesterol foods, or you should only eat a vegetarian diet. I believe that everything is a question of balance, and if you're going to eat something from the extremes, if you're going to have balance, you've got to take the extremes into account. So therefore, if I have, say, a Sunday carvery with fatty roast pork, I will probably have a vegetarian meal the following day, or eat fish, and I will balance out my diet to keep my cholesterol down, and I take exercise, and as I say, I do probably a very physically demanding sport. I do a violent contact sport for relaxation.
Martin, what about your health and fitness?
Oh, well, Tony,
and diet.
That's something that we better draw a veil over, I think, and move on to the next item.
Okay. The next one is tough choices for the armed forces, and this is the green paper which came out this week about Britain's armed forces, and apparently they'll have to cooperate more closely in future with international allies such as France to provide a full range of defence capabilities. capabilities. And this is according to the Defence Secretary, Bob Ainsworth. One of the other aspects of this Defence Green Paper is that it looks like much more money will be being spent on counterinsurgency type equipment and training rather than traditional Navy, Army and Air Force. Martin, I'll ask you to start on this one. What are your thoughts about this Green Paper?
Well, I mean, we've got to start assessing what kind of threats we actually face, and I would suggest that what we really need to do is beef up our police services to try and catch whoever it is that's supposedly terrorising us. And I don't presume that that's necessarily going to be mad Muslims.
But where does the? I mean, that's a separate issue. This is the armed forces, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got a the obvious elephant in the room with all of this is Trident, a nuclear weapon. I mean, it costs a fortune. They've got no boots in Afghanistan, but we can afford nuclear weapons we can't use. I mean, that's what the government should have been saying. I mean, the obvious thing to say is, right, if we need more resources for the army, for example, on the front line in Afghanistan, leaving aside whether we should be in Afghanistan, that's another question. But clearly, if you're going to go there, you want to have the right kit. And if you haven't got enough money because of the recession or the crisis or whatever, well, you've got to make tough choices. And the obvious tough choice to make is get rid of nuclear weapons and make a virtue of that. Just say, yes, we used to have nuclear weapons, we've given them up, just like South Africa. And I don't see that we'd be in any worse state than we are now. I mean, what protection do nuclear weapons offer to Britain? It's basically just a white elephant.
It does seem with this Green Paper that there is a real, there's going to be more of an emphasis, certainly in the initial stages of this consultation. There's going to be much more of an emphasis on a kind of counterinsurgency policing role for the army.
No, but what worries me about this is exactly what's happening in the US, where they're saying we need money for counterinsurgency, blah, 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 but we're going to carry on having more nuclear weapons as well. They're going to increase defence spending in the US by 7% this year, even though all other government expenditure is going to be cut back. I mean, this is just bonkers.
Well, I've always believed that Britain should maintain a minimum nuclear deterrent. I mean, we've already got enough nuclear weapons in our arsenal. Without the American one and the French arsenal, the Russian and the Chinese arsenal, we've got enough to destroy the world. Apart from the sea-launched cruise missiles and the overhaul of Trident, we've also still got airdrop missiles, and airdrop bombs that the RAF can deliver with small blast range tactical battlefield nuclear devices. And I think a minimum nuclear deterrent is necessary. But when you talk about counterinsurgency and this sort of thing, you then, without getting involved in semantics here, you've got to decide whether we're talking about defence. They call it defence budget and defence with the armed forces, or aggression. I mean, we come back to, were we the aggressors, or were we defending ourselves by going to Iraq? Are we defending ourselves in Afghanistan on the other side of the world? Or are we an aggressor, which is how we might be seen there?
Well, this is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in the Hindu Kush. We're quite a long way from the Atlantic there, aren't we? And I understood, I read a story in the Times about British soldiers when they first arrived in Helmand Province. They were doing this Hearts and Minds operation, and they set up a television screen in this village, and they showed people pictures of the Blue Planet, the BBC series, lots of whales and porpoises. And of course, these Afghan peasants are somewhat bemused by this. And then they left the meeting that they'd had with the locals, and as they were walking away, the commander turned to the female journalist from the Times and said, "I think that went rather well, don't you?" Then the insurgents opened fire and they were pinned down for 3 days, and they had to send a column out from Sangat to come and rescue them. I mean, it really is. Before you decide what armed forces you need, you've got to decide what wars it is you're fighting and why you're fighting them. And this is a real question. I mean, what are we doing, charging around the world trying to tell them what to do?
Well, when you're talking about American defence budgets, British defence budgets, let's look at Scandinavian countries and things like that, shall we? I mean, and this is where we talk about the semantics of attack and defence and what you have to defend yourself from. I mean, these Scandinavian countries are not got a terrorist problem. They don't have to defend themselves against the insurgents. Why? They don't have a foreign policy. They don't stick their nose in other people's affairs. They don't get involved where there's oil and things like that. So therefore, they don't have to have a fortune spent on supposed defence because they're not under attack.
Okay, final story is we can look at Labour slamming the proposal for Bristol library cuts. The Evening Post has revealed that the council officials are planning £200,000 worth of cuts in the service, library service, which will mean many job losses. There are also plans to spend £500,000 on new technology to create a self-service system so users will be able to issue and return their own books. That was in the Bristol Evening Post last weekend. Martin, I mean, are you someone that uses the library a lot?
I am, actually. I use the Central Library a lot. I'm borrowing books from there all the time because I don't like spending a lot of money on books, and they get all the new history books that I like. They get them all in as soon as they're published, so I often go to that library, and I use the library service a lot.
OK, Jerry, could you just have in a couple of sentences your thoughts on library cut proposals?
Well, I've always thought that libraries are key, really. I mean, especially for younger generations, reference libraries and other libraries, they need to be able to read.
Lovely. Now, we're just coming up to the Sky News at 6. We'll be back in a minute and talk further to Jerry and hear from our ex-paratrooper, whistleblower.
Radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.